Hello, listeners. The following episode contains aspects of a disease that exists in real life. Any language surrounding the disease that comes across as offensive is only used from personal experience. Further content warnings can be found in the episode description. Thank you, and enjoy. I know it's around here somewhere. I remember this beige wall.
Aren't all the walls painted beige?
No. Some are taupe, some are tan, and one hallway is ecru. Oblivious as always, John.
You know, Jane, on our 2-week journey to find the, peeling room, I was thinking...
Oh dear, did it hurt?
I was thinking I've gotten kind of used to the rash. I mean, these guys are kind of cute, don't you think?
No.
Well, I've grown kind of attached to them, and...
They've attached to you. We don't know if they're, like, siphoning your life force or something.
Maybe it's a symbiotic relationship.
And what do you gain from it?
Friendship.
Why would you want to be friends with that thing when I'm right here?
Are you saying that we're friends?
What? No. Now hurry up and keep looking so we can peel your skin off.
Do I have to?
It won't be that bad. We'll get ice cream afterward.
Gee whiz, no fooling?
Oh, you found it.
So, how long does this usually take?
No idea. Even our best attempts to estimate time have fallen flat. Let's just assume it'll be around the time it takes to read this letter from the benefactors. So just stay there until you don't hear me reading anymore.
But...
It's a funny thing, getting diagnosed with the disease you've had your whole life. You sit across from the dermatologist, propped up on his weird little table as he goes over your skin like it's some kind of ancient tome. He reads the faint scars on the palms of your hands and the soles of your feet like they're the most fascinating text he's ever read, and his gloved hands poke and prod at fresh and old blisters alike. He tries to be gentle, to not hurt you, but the pressure feels uncomfortable all the same. You squirm uncomfortably on the paper-covered exam table, feeling all too seen. He hums when he finds a blood blister hiding on the back of your ankle, and quickly scribbles down a note. He leaves you then, and wanders off to consult his books. You're left sitting awkwardly in the cold room until he returns with a phrase you've never heard before. Epidermolysis bullosa simplex, he says, but there's nothing simple about it. You're in your crawling phase when your parents first notice it. Angry red rubs form on your chubby little hands and knees as you explore your surroundings, and the next morning those rubs have turned into ugly, distended blisters that engulf your joints. The ones on your palms spread out when you put too much pressure on them, and the ones on your knees burst. Where the blisters don't form, you've got open lesions that leave thick, viscous fluid and stains on your mother's carpet. Each night, before she puts you down to sleep, she puts Neosporin on every open wound. Each morning, she does it again. It pains her to hear her little one wail in pain, but there's no other way to keep them from getting infected. By the time you're up and running around with the other kids, the blisters have spread to your feet. While the other kids toddle, you limp your gimpy little way around the playground. The blisters on your feet are more resilient than the ones on your knees were, but as calluses slowly begin to form, your mother more and more often finds bloody little pockets buried below the thick, dead skin. She starts draining the blisters when she notices that you can't really walk well, and replaces Neosporin with hydrogen peroxide. This does a better job of stopping infections, but it burns like a son of a bitch, and you shriek every time it begins to bubble. Your mother and father do their best to soothe you, but by the time your treatment is done, your poor little throat is so hoarse you can't speak. Once you turn 8, you start to realize that your condition is putting a strain on your parents. The blisters are as bad as ever, and now the calluses don't even like to stay on your body. Instead, you find them peeling off as you walk to school with your friends. On your way home, you feel the thin, bloody fluid of a burst blister fill your sneaker. You swallow the pain and teeter along next to Jerry as you head home. You lag just a little bit behind, though. When you turn 10, you begin to resent the pitying way your parents look at you. Despite your best attempts to hold in the pain, to hide it, they can see it in the subtle ways you act. You can't hide the way your face screws up in pain when you step on an open wound, or the sharp gasp of air you suck in when the salt shaker spills onto your hand. You can't hide the dry, choked sobs you let slip out at night, curled up in bed after a long day of walking on broken skin. To your parents' credit, they don't say anything. Their pity, though, is in their faces, in the way they gently tend to your wounds and pat your head. The day after you turn 11, you decide that you're old enough to take care of yourself. You lose count of the endless nights you spend seated on the bathroom floor, methodically draining each blister with your back pressed against the edge of the bathtub. Just a week after you turn 12, your mother buys you a pair of forearm crutches. The pharmacist told her that they might help take the pressure off your feet. You hate that she talks about you, about your condition, but you try to remind yourself that she means well. The canes were probably expensive, and your family's a little tight on money as it is. She gives them to you and watches you hobble off to school with Jerry. Once you two are around the corner and out of sight, he nabs one of them and takes off running, leaving you to limp lamely behind him. So your school days go. Some kids bug you, calling you things like Gimp and the Cripple. But those names go away once you ditch the canes. The damn things took most of the skin off your hands, anyway. You're 18 and about to graduate when the war breaks out. Boys start enlisting. News broadcasts start showing footage of the war. And then they stop enlisting. Boys from the next town over start kicking and screaming as they're dragged off to war. And 2 months later, they're shipped home in pieces. Jerry skips town and you go with him. There's a special name for kids like this. Draft dodgers. So what? A boy like you wouldn't last a second in boot camp. You and Jerry are 3 towns over when they catch you. You try to bolt, but it's pointless. Your little scheme has been found out, and now you're going to defend your country whether you like it or not. Defend is a funny word choice in context, but you don't dare say that to the 6'7" wall of commanding officer who drags your sorry ass off to camp. You try to protest, claim disability, but wouldn't you know it? All that driving gave your blisters a chance to heal up, and the dried-up pockmarks on the soles of your feet do little to convince him of your condition. You and Jer get split up, and before long you're in your brand-new ill-fitting fatigues and 2 tight combat boots. The second you, hunched over on your bunk, yank those boots onto your feet, you feel the skin pull off. This is going to be hell. And you're right. It is hell. Every training exercise they have you do brings new blisters, new lesions pulling at your skin. Your hands are pulled apart by obstacle courses, and your feet eaten up by every move you make. Even your joints have blisters rubbed into them, because your uniform is not designed for comfort. One night, when you remove your boots, skin comes with them. You notice a thin trail of pus sliding down your ankle, but it's nothing a quick trip to the infirmary can't fix. You have hope that the medic takes pity on you then, despite the fact that you hate pity, but he doesn't. He just pours some alcohol on your wounds and sends you back into the training yard. Learn to suck it up, more than you ever have. Your lips are permanently stitched back, sutured tight against your gums to bare your teeth in what should be a grin but looks like a grimace. Each day pulls more skin from your body, fills new blisters, and by the end of your 8 weeks you're almost relieved to be shipped off, finally free from hell. Well, you know what they say. Out of the frying pan and into the fire. The second the cloying humidity of the jungle hits your face, any hope of survival is sucked out of you. Who cares if you get shot in the head or blown up? This place is a breeding ground for infection, and your condition carves out the perfect habitat. There's no turning back now, though. You're in the thick of it. Distantly, you wonder where Jerry is. It only takes a week with your platoon before your condition has gone full throttle towards misery. You haven't had the chance to check, but you're pretty certain that there's no skin left attached to your feet. Your hands are much the same. Your fingers are so red and bloodied they're nearly purple, thick blood spilling into clustered blisters around the crooks. Your palms have so many blisters you lost count. The burst ones are easier to keep track of. 13. White creeps in at the edges of those, but you manage to keep them at bay with a little bottle of alcohol you keep in your pack. By the middle of the second week, you have to ration it. By the end of the third week, you're entirely out. You resort to washing your wounds in whatever running water you can find, and hope that none of the enemy soldiers spot you doing it. The third week is misery. Blisters have formed all over your body in places you didn't think you could even get them. Your boots squelch every time you move. It's tough to tell if it's the mud making that noise or your lack of flesh. The pain is searing, but at some point you go numb to it. No time to feel pain when you're getting shot at the very least. One day, when your platoon is taking a breather somewhere deep in the uncharted jungle, you bend over to inspect your ankle, raw and red. Something whizzes over your head and catches your buddy Mark square in the temple and he drops like a sack of potatoes. You stay on the ground and scramble for your gun. It's over a month now and by God, do you want to go home. By now, you're certain there's no skin left on your feet, but what can you do? Around you, your friends and comrades are dropping like flies. Half of them are flown home on stretchers, the other half in body bags. You almost envy Trevor Clancy, who's sent home in pieces. Your platoon is down 10 men, though. No way they're sending you home for a couple of measly blisters. It isn't until you go into sepsis that anyone realizes the blisters might be a little more than measly. You drop like a rock, and at first your CO thinks you got shot. You're too out of it to know what happened, and by the time you've reached the medic outpost, you've thrown up twice. You float in and out of consciousness as you lay on that gurney for God only knows how long. There's no pain when they remove the boots, but you do catch the words necrosis and maggots spoken between the medical staff. You're not sent home in a box, thankfully, but you are sent home on that very gurney you were put on 2 weeks ago. Your bed sores are nothing compared to the lack of skin on your feet. It's in another U.S. hospital before you're even able to approximate walking again, but at least that mosaic of blisters on your hands has dried and peeled away. Once you're out of the hospital, you return to your parents with one less leg. Your mother dotes on you more than she ever has before. You don't wish you were back in the jungle. You do wish you were anywhere else, though. Things aren't like when your father came back from the Pacific. There's no fanfare, not that you would want any. Yet you can't ignore the nasty glares you get, the way protesters look at you like you're some kind of traitor. You want to scream at them, tell them that you were one of them once, but you don't bother. Instead, you just hobble along down the street on your crutches, trying to shift the weight off one side of your hand as a fresh blister bubbles its way out of your skin. Things go like this until you meet her. She holds the door open for you as you hobble into a cafe, and she's the first person your age to smile at you in months. Her name is Mary, and she becomes your world. She doesn't prod about your time overseas, and she doesn't inquire about your condition. She's kind, patient, funny, and wears sundresses remarkably well. A year and a half later, you and Mary are wed, and you wear your new prosthetic on the wedding day. You don't care if it causes blisters on your stub, because it means you get to dance with your wife for what you hope is the first time of many. Things go well, amazingly well. You feel happy for the first time in ages, too many years to count. There's only one problem. Mary wants to have children. It's not like you don't like kids. In fact, you've always dreamed about having them. Not just one, either. You want at least two, so your children could have the sibling bond you never did. There's a nagging feeling at the back of your mind, though. A blister on the brain. One that will never burst because you're too scared you'll chase Mary off. Your condition. So you try, boy, do you try, to stop from having kids. You take every precaution that you can, telling Mary that you just aren't ready. She understands, you know, but you can see a look in her eyes that resembles longing. It's not like your precautions matter anyway, because ultimately, they fail. Mary misses her time of the month, and boom, she's pregnant. Your chest fills with a mixed fluid of emotions, joy and regret and worry. But Mary's happy. Lord, she's overjoyed. So like always, you suck it up. Grin and bear it. Your son is born, and all that regret goes out the window. He's perfect, little James. He looks just like his mother. He doesn't have her temperament, though. He cries all the time, until his poor little throat is hoarse, and he still cries when he has no voice. 2 weeks into his existence, you notice it. You think at first that it's diaper rash, but it's not. It's blisters, all too familiar, broken open all over his little body. It's a funny thing to get diagnosed with a disease you've had your whole life. It's considerably less funny having to bring your 3-week-old son to the dermatologist for what you think is the same thing. It takes all your strength to hand James over to the doctor, and even more to hold it together as he begins to explain what's wrong. The doctor levels you with a look, one you've known since childhood. Pity brims in his eyes, threatens to spill over. His creased mouth spreads into a thin line. Dystrophic epidermolysis bullosa, the doctor says gravely, handing James back over to you as gently as he can. I'm sorry, Ted. The end. All right, I think you've been in there long enough. You can come out now, John. John? Oh, right, the lock. Oh, well, the lesion is gone.
Yeah, I wasn't too worried about that, Jane. I think around the time the room had sloughed off my muscular tissue, I knew it had been detached.
I don't know why you're getting snippy with me. Ivory is very in right now.
Jane, I'm a skeleton.
So, is that a no on the ice cream?
Of course I want ice cream, Jane!
I don't think I like your tone.
No, wait, Jane, come back!
Uncommon Commons is a podcast. It was written and recorded by George Plank and Alex Vitale. Our logo was designed by Sam Vitale, and our theme song was written by Charles Adam Robinson. Special thanks to our patrons, including Noel San, who contributed at the $5 level. For $1 a month, get access to all of our bonus content, including The Common Area and our ongoing actual play podcast, Need to Escape. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode. Stay. And remember, nothing is real.